It is February the 17th, 2005, and you are?
I'm George Foote. I retired as a group captain in 1958 as from the Royal Air Force.
All right. Group Captain Foote, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions. On October 4th, 1938, you started elementary flying training school at Sywell in Shropshire, England. You were still a civilian, but you were being paid. Tell me about that arrangement.
It was April the 4th, 1938,
mm-hmm.
Right? I got orders, after I had been accepted, I got orders in March, 1 year, one week before the absolute optimum time that you could join. I was 24 and 51 weeks old. And I got orders then to go to Sywell. And Sywell was a civilian elementary flying training school. We were paid 16 and sixpence a day. And they took off 12 and sixpence a day for board and room. So we had 4 shillings to spend on beer.
So who was paying you?
The Royal Air Force.
Oh, the Royal Air Force, but you were still a civilian.
Yes, as a civilian. And we had to get our civil license. If we could get the civil license, then they figured we were okay to go ahead with flying training. It was a very inexpensive way to sort people out.
So if a person washed out of flying training as a civilian...
They didn't go ahead. If they washed out at EFTS, which was civilian, then you didn't go and get your commission.
I see. Okay. But you were lucky. You made your own luck. The Royal Air Force accepted you and commissioned you after you had received your civilian flying license on Tiger Moths.
That's right.
July 23rd, 1938, you reported to RAF Station Turnhill in Shropshire, dressed as an acting pilot officer on probation.
That's right, yeah. We had been sent to Uxbridge, first of all, mm-hmm. after we graduated from the Elementary Flying Training School, EFTS. We went to Uxbridge, and there we learned mess etiquette. We were given our Manual of Air Force Law, our King's Regulations, and we were kitted out completely, utterly, in our uniforms, etc., mm-hmm. etc., with no wings. And then we were sent to flying training school.
So tell me about your early days as a Royal Air Force officer.
Well, we went to Turnhill, and there were 44 of us. Mm-hmm. I might say that 4 of us lasted out the war. Only 4 came back. Anyway, we were divided into 3 squads, with a squadron, senior squad commander, South African by the name of Fisher. And I was made a squadron commander. And after about a month and a half or more, it was obvious that Fisher wasn't doing the job. Because you have to control everybody. These kids are all 19, 20, 21, you know. And so he was taken off, and they made me senior squad commander.
Hmm.
And I was senior squad commander all the way through. I led the parades
So what sort of, was there mess life? Were you all living in barracks?
We lived in a beautiful quarters in Turnhill. And we were only the second term to go in there. So when we were there, there was a senior term. The junior term got used to flying that type of aircraft you're going to go on to. The senior term was the equivalent of what they call the operational training unit. We did our bombing exercises and various things like that. So there were 2 terms. Anyway, I became senior squadron commander. And it was very good. We had a very good group.
So your meals were provided?
We had 3 meals a day, etc. Every night, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, we were in mess kit. Saturday, we were in dinner jackets. Sunday, we had to wear lounge suits. That's for dinner in the evening. And our dinner normally comprised of 5-6 courses, and it was all done very formally.
Every day?
Every day, Monday through Friday, with the president saying, "Mr. Vice, the king," and Mr. Vice would stand up and say, "Gentlemen, the king," and we'd toast the king. It was tremendous. Hmm. And then once a month they would have a dining-in night. And instead of wearing a blue waistcoat, we wore a white waistcoat and white gloves.
Hmm.
It was a tremendous experience.
Quite formal.
Very.
For a young man from Winnipeg.
But from Winnipeg, yeah, you know.
Yeah.
Now, the English boys maybe a lot of it, like Hardy McCarty, who is a chum of mine. Now, he came back from Robert Bruce's idea, you know. And they had a great big estate in Wales. So they were used to that sort of thing. When I go to him there with the weekend with them, I had to take my dinner jacket, because we had a dinner jacket at night, everything, you know.
What sort of things did you do on weekends? You were off work on weekends?
On weekends, yeah. Normally we would go into Turnhill and go to the pub, and we'd have beer and the plowman's lunch, you know, great big chunk of cheese, a jar of pickled onions,
yep,
and a beautiful bread. And we would tour around the country. Some of the boys had cars, mm-hmm, and you saw one of them
in my
photo library, yeah. We would go to London, maybe, you know. I would go to my aunt's for the weekend, but generally speaking, we were off.
Yeah.
But a really interesting thing was that it was the time of the Hurricane, the first monoplane fighter in the RAF, and that they did their tactics, how they're going to attack with a monoplane against biplanes. So they used the latest biplane fighter, and then the Hurricanes would attack. And they found that the one with the two wings,
yeah,
of course, could turn in much smaller circle. So they had to adopt different measures. And the chap who was doing that was a wing commander, Batchy Atcherley, very famous in the Royal Air Force. He was one of twins.
So they were working out tactics?
Tactics for the Hurricane.
For the Hurricane.
Yeah, and then later on in the senior term, the Spitfire came along. The Spitfire came along after that, not too long after that.
So what aircraft were you flying?
I was flying at that, in flying training school, the Anson.
Oh, okay.
Which was a twin engine. So I was destined for twin engine, for multi-engine aircraft.
Because you were going
flying boats. That's where I was asking. I taught flying boats from the moment I got in there until it happened.
So when did they decide that you would go on flying boats?
Well, we had to get our wings first. And so we had the big wings parade. And then the air officer commanding personally came along and pinned your wings on for you, which was a big formal parade. And so I'd have to put the boys through their paces. I learned from the warrant officers, of course,
yeah,
but then I had to do it. And then we went into senior term. And then at the end of senior term,
mm-hmm,
we took off the acting when we got our wings, and they took off on probation when we got our wings, and they took off the acting when we completely passed out of flying training school as a fully trained officer.
Yeah. So, were you able to ask for flying?
Okay.
Boats?
Yes, that's the question. I sometimes have a little trouble holding your question because my head's so full. They would discuss with us from time to time, you know, what happened. And I kept on saying, well, I want to get on a flying boat because I wanted to fly the Pan-American clippers, you know, or the transatlantic, or the Empire flying boats. And so when the postings came in, the training command would discuss with the other commands what was available, and then they sent it to the station. Mm. So there's so many flying boats, so many bombers, so many fighters, so many... if they weren't too good at pilots, they went to an Army co-op and flew the smaller aircraft. Mm-hmm. But there was only one flying boat vacancy. But as you can see from my record, I passed out top of the class. And so I got my flying boats.
You got your first choice.
So when the list came up, we didn't know. And there it was in front of it. And there I was on the flying boats.
Pretty happy.
That was a happy occasion, yes.
So on our first tape, we talked about your flying boat experiences, some in Gibraltar and mostly in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
I'd like to fast forward now in time to August of 1945. So you've been flying boats through the war.
I have been flying boats
for Coastal Command
until December of 41.
Okay.
At that time, I was due for arrest. Mm-hmm. And I went to Prince Albert, to Port Albert, Prince Albert in Ontario.
Okay.
And there I took the specialist navigation course.
Right. Okay. Anyhow, I'd like to fast forward to August of 1945.
Yes.
The Japanese surrendered, and you were serving at a Royal Air Force station at Ratmalana, near Colombo in Sri Lanka.
Okay. In 1945, on the 12th of June, the 12th of June, I was posted to the Far East. Mm-hmm. And I got to New Delhi, mm-hmm. and I went in to see the air officer commanding the Far East there. And so he said, well, I'm going to send you down to command the staging post at Ratmalana, and it may involve being the commanding officer of the station. So that's how I got there.
And tell me what was at Ratmalana then.
It was basically a staging place. There were no active military fighters or anything. Aircraft would come from England through the various bases, through these staging posts, and I had full facilities for maintaining aircraft. They came in, we billeted the boys, looked after them, and then their aircraft were serviced, and they would go on. Now that was the end, that was the last one from England at that time. And then on that station I had four Liberators of 232 Squadron Detachment.
Okay. But these were they
and, and they were to go to Australia. So you could go from England, because you see there were no civil type of aircraft there working then. You could go from England right to Sydney, Australia, through these various staging posts, of which Ratmalana was the last one on for most of them. And then from there, they flew from there to Cocos Islands, which was halfway exactly between Ratmalana and Guildford, the RAAF station at Perth. Mm-hmm. And from there, if necessary, they went across to Sydney, and if necessary, they would go across to New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And then come back to Ratmalana.
So from Ratmalana, would anybody be going directly, staging directly from Ratmalana to fight the Japanese directly? Or they would have to go to another base?
Previously, yeah. During the war, yes. Mm-hmm. Of course they did, yeah. And they had flying boats there, two Catalinas.
Well, they did.
You see, because they found the Japanese fleet, you know, from Catalina.
Oh, yes.
Operating out of Ceylon.
Len Burchell,
you see. And he was down at the bottom of Ceylon. With his station.
Did you meet Len Burchell?
No, I never met him.
He was
because you see
he was in prison
then.
Yeah.
Because when I was there, you know, everything was very nice.
Now, you were in Radmalana when the Soviets declared war on Japan. Did that news filter to you? So the war in Europe had ended, and the Americans were firebombing Japan.
That's right, but that was August the 15th, the war in Japan finished.
Right.
August the 15th, 45.
Yeah. But were you in Radmalana then?
I was in Radmalana at that mm-hmm. time. And also there, Lord Mountbatten, who was in charge of the whole of the Far East, he's had his headquarters at Candy in Ceylon. Mm-hmm. So my base also handled him.
Okay, so Mountbatten.
Yeah. But in October of 45, I got instructions that I had to move Radmalana up to a place called Negumbo, which was 25 miles north of Colombo. It was destined, before the war ended, to handle the Lincoln bomber, the largest bomber in the Air Force at that time. And it had the longest and the widest airstrip in the whole of the RAF. And it had been built right in the middle of a coconut plantation. I went up there and took a couple of boys with me to look it over, and obviously it wasn't going to be really ready for the airmen. There were going to be no amenities. They didn't have too many laborers working on it. And anyway, we had to move. And before we moved, I got all the airmen together in the hangar with no officers. And I said, look, you know, things are going to be rough up there, but we've got to move. But I want something from you, and I'll give something to you. I want, when we get there, to ensure that the aircraft are kept serviceable, on time, and the crews are looked after. That's number one priority. And my number one priority was to get amenities going for you. So I will do that if you do this. And they all said, well, that's great. Because they got a ration of beer and had to go to their beds, you know.
Oh, yes, yes.
And anyway, we got there and we were working. Now, there's a great surplus of senior officers.
Okay, I think we covered that last time.
We did, didn't we?
Yes.
And when a group captain came in.
That's right, and you swapped hats.
That happened. Yeah, that's right. I had gone to Dum Dum.
Yep.
You've got that, have you?
Yes.
Yeah, well, you have that. And I came back and we found the boys had gone on strike.
Yeah. Let me ask you about you're taking the airmen without any other officers there.
Yeah.
My first question is, did the airmen know that you were Canadian-born rather than British-born?
Oh, sure.
Do you think that made a difference?
No.
Okay.
No. I don't. Only once was there ever anything said in any of my reports about me being Canadian, it made a difference.
Mm-hmm.
Only once. And he was the son of a gun anyway.
Well, let me.
But
quote,
you see, here I am.
Let me quote from that son of a gun.
That's a different one.
This is a different one.
He was in Air Ministry. Yeah. No, this is Boy Boucher here.
So we've got Air Vice Marshal Boucher.
Yeah.
In, looks like, October 1947.
That's right.
And he is in Japan.
Yes.
And he writes about you.
Yes.
A Canadian-born officer of the Royal Air Force who was recently selected for the grant of a permanent commission, but a small stomach disorder for the time being has prevented him from being passed out as AI. AI?
A fitness? A1.
Oh, A1.
Yeah.
By the medical authorities. A fine, robust, and splendid type of officer. I have never met in a long career an officer to whom the Royal Air Force means more, or a man who puts so much heart and all his energies into his job. I hold the highest possible opinion of this officer, who is a good organizer and gets things done without any fuss. Possesses an active, happy, and very likable personality. Signed, Boucher. So here he's mentioned that you're Canadian.
Yeah.
Do you think he was trying to separate you from the British-born officers or the South African-born?
I don't know that. I never thought about it, really, you know. I was a Canadian. Yeah, sure, I was Canadian, but I was Royal Air Force. I was never treated other than that as a member of the Royal Air Force, because the Royal Air Force comprised Australians, New Zealanders, South Africans, Indians, Canadians. See, we're all in.
All together.
All together, before the war.
Right.
When war started, then their air forces came over. So pre-war, there were all kinds of different nationalities in the Royal Air Force.
Yeah. We're going to get to some more of your Cold War adventures, but I have one more question about being in the Far East. You were in the RAF, at an RAF base in India, when the British granted independence and Pakistan split from India. Is that correct?
No, that was August. I was in Japan.
Oh, you were in Japan.
I was in Japan. It was August the 15th, 47. See here, I was there. August of 1547 was when Lord Louis Mountbatten organized the splitting of India and into India and Pakistan. Now, we had two Royal Air Force. I was at Miho at the time on the north coast of Honshu, M-I-H-O. H-O-N-S-H-U.
Mm-hmm.
And we had two Indian squadron of Hurricanes fighters on board. From that day onwards, they had been friends, mm-hmm. but from that day onwards, they never spoke to each other again.
Between the Hindus and the Muslims?
That's right. They had different messes, of course, because they had they eat entirely differently.
Yeah. And how did that affect operations at the base?
Well, don't forget that the occupation force was there, but they didn't have any problems to worry about. You know, the Japanese were so defeated and down, dispirited and everything, they never had kicked up any fuss at all. The men were a bit arrogant, but there was no problem with them.
But as far as the Hindu and Muslim airmen that you had on your base?
Yes.
Was there any difficulty between those?
No, I don't recall any difficulty. Things went along as normal, except they were no longer friends. They didn't talk.
Mm-hmm. Were they repatriated?
They were both there before I left.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. When I left, they were still there. And I don't know where they went.
Okay.
Because you see, when I left there, the British Commonwealth Air sort of packed up. England couldn't afford it anymore.
Sure.
So what happened to our New Zealand squadron and Australian squadrons and the Indian and Pakistanis, I really don't know.
All right. I'd like to fast forward a little bit more to Brixmas.
Yes.
We talked on the first tape about Brixmas and some of the things that you did.
Yeah.
So I'd like you to tell me a bit about the formation of Brixmas, because it was really an unusual intelligence gathering unit, wasn't it?
Okay. You know, Brixmas, and I might add the Cold War, were both intrinsically tied together in East Germany. Brixmas was a small British military unit comprising Army, about 9 officers, RAF, 3 officers, Navy, 1 officer, and a representative of JIB, Joint Intelligence Bureau, who was given the rank, honorary rank of a lieutenant colonel in an Army uniform.
But he was civilian?
He was civilian. And this elite unit was very little known then. It was very little known throughout its whole existence. And it's still relatively unknown. Now, there is no secret about it anymore. But it served in East Germany from 1946 until 1990, when the Soviet forces withdrew So it was there all the time. And if you look there on the wall,
oh yeah,
Potsdam, British Commander in Chief's mission to the Soviet forces in Germany, with both our flags.
The Soviet flag and the British flag.
That's right, Joe. The way it happened, of course, is quite lengthy, but if we just say that there were a lot of conferences and various things went on prior to it, I'm sure in your thesis you're going to, but you don't need all these dates. The upshot of it was that there would be four zones, Soviet, British, French, American, and the same would apply in Berlin. That there would be a military government headed by the commander-in-chief of the forces. And at that time, it was Air Chief Marshal Sir Sholto Douglas who was governor. And the interesting thing is that the whole outfit was controlled by the Foreign Office. So here you've got a governor reporting to Foreign Offices, but an Air Chief Marshal is not reporting really to, although he's in charge of the Air Force of Occupation, he's the governor. And he had a liaison staff, and this applies to the others, so that they could talk with the Soviets, and the Soviets had liaison too. But the whole thing was completely unsatisfactory. So,
In what way was it unsatisfactory?
Well, it just didn't work.
Hmm.
They saw the opportunity for intelligence, but it didn't work, you see. Hmm. So what happened was the Army personnel were transferred to the BAOR, and the RAF were transferred to what became the 2nd Tactical Air Force. Where are we now? Just switch it off a second.
Sorry. Okay.
As early as November 44, there was a London agreement by the Soviets, United States, and Brits talking about what they're going to do with Germany, even that early, when they've defeated them. They were sure they were going to defeat them. Then in February 45, there was a Yalta conference with Stalin, Roosevelt, and Churchill. And, of course, they gave in to Stalin to a great extent. And, you know, here we've got a war where an enemy is defeated, but there are no treaties. There's just agreements.
Hmm.
And then we have August the 2nd, 45, they had a Potsdam Agreement, which included the French.
But would you say that those were binding?
No, they were building up.
Yeah.
They were building up. But the Potsdam Agreement really set things up. Okay? They set it up so that the Soviets would agree to allow free passage through their zone.
Mm-hmm.
Into Berlin, because Berlin was right smack in the middle of their zone. So they allowed free passage up this through rail and cars on certain routes. Of course, it was divided into the same in Berlin. But there were no written agreement. Roosevelt said, we don't need a written agreement. We can trust this guy. That was his idea. See, there was no written agreement. And here we have peace without any treaties. So the originally, as I said, they had the military government, but when this didn't prove satisfactory, they set up what is known as the Robertson-Malinin formal agreement.
Right.
Okay. Now, Robertson was the commander-in-chief of the British Army of the Rhine, and Malinin was the commander-in-chief, Marshal Malinin, General Robertson. Malinin was the CNC of the Soviet forces. And this was written, this was on paper, and it was signed, and it was in both Russian and in English. And basically, the agreement provided for each commander-in-chief would have a mission. And there would be a chief of mission. And the chief would be accredited to the Soviet CNC, representing the CNC, as far as I'm concerned, the RAF. Mm-hmm. But this happened with all of them. They all had these representations.
Including the United States military liaison?
Oh, yeah, their chief.
Yeah.
Their mission was smaller. The French mission was smaller. The British was the largest. The British they had a brigadier as the chief of mission. The others had the equivalent. They had an army colonel, mm-hmm. and the French had the equivalent. And at that time, the Soviet military, the Soviet CNC was one Marshal Grechko, Grechko. I guess you would spell it. I can do it in Russian, but. he was commander-in-chief of the Soviet forces. Now, they don't have an air force.
Right.
They had the 24th. It's an air army.
Right.
It's all part of the army. So that was the 24th Air Army there. What happened was, in this agreement, the British had the British commander-in-chief's mission to the Soviets in Germany. Not East Germany, just in Germany. And this was very cumbersome. It's on a